Welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. This is the podcast where we explore the people and stories that make up the tech and venture ecosystem. Don't forget to subscribe, like, rate, and share the podcast because it really helps us get the word out to more people who are curious about understanding even more about the world of venture capital. This season of Nothing Ventured is sponsored by Odin. Odin helps angels, VCs, and founders to raise and deploy capital seamlessly. You can structure your SPVs and now run your funds, handle capital calls, portfolio management more smoothly and easily in one place. Founders use Odin to raise their entire round in a few clicks by simply sending investors a link and receiving investments immediately. Odin works with over 5,000 investors and over 150 emerging fund managers and angel syndicates globally. Head to joinodin.com to learn more. That's joinodin.com. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today on the podcast, I have with me Renan de Villiers. Renan is the founder of OSS Ventures, a startup studio building and investing in the future of operations. OSS ideates, tests, builds, and invests in great ideas to change the future of the organizations who provide physical services to the world. Previous to starting OSS, Renan co-founded Chance, a recruitment tech business, which at one point had one in every 30 jobs in Brazil going through the platform. Renan took an exit as the venture raised its Series B. In today's episode, we talked about walking into a Tesla factory and having the epiphany that this was the future of manufacturing, coding up a business model in Europe that turned out to be illegal, so pivoting to Brazil. The fact that operations is 25% of GDP, 50% of workers, 60% of emissions, and 90% of the economy being hardware, but only 0.7% of VC funding going towards it. We talked about hardware as a base platform for software, reducing batch sizes down to individual personalization, and how there have been more factories built in the last 18 months in the US than in the prior 6 years. Let's get straight into it. Renan, it's great to have you here on the podcast with me. For our audience to get to know you a bit better, let's do a bit of a quick fire. So when you're ready, what was your first job?
I was a consultant.
Okay, not the most interesting. Anyway, that's fine. What did you do before you got into the tech and venture ecosystem?
I was a factory director.
Okay, and what triggered your move into building OSS?
I made 400 calls. Uh-huh. And realized that I would lose my money if I invest.
Okay, got it. And what would you be doing if you hadn't have founded OSS?
Probably I would be a math teacher.
A math teacher, amazing. Okay. And let's talk about OSS. Who's it for? What does it do? And what does it do better?
Yep. So OSS is a venture builder. So our business model is the same as an investment fund. We hold shares in fast-growing tech companies. Mm-hmm. The particularity is that we invest and or create companies. And the thing that we do better than anybody, because we are the only ones to do it, is that we focus on software for operations. And so that's what we do all day, every day. We have a network of more than 800 factories in which we are able to put software and understand the pain points and everything. And that unique network leads us to create software companies that no one would think of.
Amazing. And if you think about three ventures that you're excited about, either inside or outside of your portfolio, what would they be?
I would choose two inside my portfolio and one outside. In my portfolio, there is a Full Speed Automation. Mm-hmm. Full Speed Automation is a company that lets you program robots just with voice. And so you say, pick the blue box, and the robot auto-programs itself, recognize the blue box and goes and pick the blue box.
Amazing.
So that would be one. Another one that I love is called WasteX, and it's managing industrial waste at scale for industrial companies. And so making sure that it's better used, sent to the right companies to make the most use and everything. And the last one is not from my portfolio, I wish, but it's not. It's called Figure. Mm-hmm. And it's building the first humanoid general purpose robot. So think a robot that can do anything a human can do.
Okay. I mean, we've had lots of conversations on this podcast about how realistic that is. But one final question. Good Bordeaux or a Chianti?
Oh, Chianti, for sure.
Ah, interesting. I love it. Moving outside of the geographic partisanship. Okay, yes. Well, look, let's dive straight into the podcast. So we often talk about co-founding journeys, but yours took a different turn. Talk us through the journey at Chance, which ultimately led to you departing the company after you and your co-founders decided to separate. What was that like? What do you wish you had done differently? And what were the lessons that you learned?
So first, I'm very grateful for that story and very grateful for Chance. We built a company aiming at giving jobs to underserved people. We scaled in Brazil. And at some point in the company, we were a big company. We were like 80 people. We disagreed with what we should do with the company. My co-founders wanted to go back to Europe. I wanted to stay between San Francisco and Brazil, which was our primary market. And we were not in agreement with the strategy. And the truth is that there are a lot of facts about strategy, but there is also a lot of guts. And I was not in agreement with my two co-founders. And so at some point we said, okay, not going to happen. We are not going to see the same thing. So it's either disagree and commit or out. And I decided out. And quite frankly, the out was good because it was done painlessly and without too much drama, and I got a bunch of money also. And the main thing that I learned is that I'm not sure I'm that good of a number two. And it sounds not very humble to say that, but I think it has a lot of value to be a good number two or a good first employee or a good employee. And it has a lot of value being a founder. And I discovered that about myself, which is that I'm probably not made out of number two material.
Yeah, I mean, I tell everyone I meet that I'm unemployable. I'm exactly the same. I think I would find it very difficult to take direction from anyone. And I mean, the whole reason you moved to Brazil in the first place was because your business model in Europe was not necessarily viable. Just talk us through that, because it feels strange then to try and pivot back.
Let's
see
the world. It was illegal. Okay. So in Europe, you have that thing called GDPR.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be protection for the user. If you ask me, it's more of a bizarre law about data and personal data. And the fact is you cannot recruit someone without a human in the loop. You cannot recruit someone based on algorithm in Europe, illegal. And so we invented an algorithm to recruit people without talking with a human, which is a great business model, but there is a law in Europe. And so we found and we created the first version, the first iteration of the product in Europe, but had to go to Brazil just to operate.
So it was essentially leave Europe or die, essentially, or get arrested even.
Yeah. No, get arrested was not on the table. But yeah, it was, and it is still strange. I think I'm seeing a lot of startups in different verticals developing something and then finding that the primary market to go is somewhere. For example, I recently learned that a lot of startups working in city tech, basically all the tech that you do for the city, they end up in Singapore because over there, the laws are just made for them to innovate.
Well, Singapore in itself is an innovative city, right? So like it's
Exactly. And so change. This is something that I discovered, which is that there are certain markets for certain things.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you could look at it more, you know, specifically in the UK, it's very much, you know, the home for fintech. For some reason, you know, well, not for some reason, Israel is incredible for defense tech, et cetera, right? So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I think each country, I mean, we're talking about competitive advantage, right? Or what those countries and or cities, you know, want to promote of themselves. And I think that creates the sort of sandboxes that allow, you know, companies to iterate. So let's talk about OSS for a second. So OSS has taken a very different route to many venture builders out there, and it has a very specific focus on factory operations. So talk me through why you decided to focus on factories and what is your process to identify and build solutions in that space?
Yeah, sure. So it's funny because sometimes you can post-rationalize something, but this is not one of those cases. Basically, I worked in manufacturing for 10 years. I was in operation. I was a factory director. I was a consultant, an economist. And then I created a tech company. And so when I made some money at my exit, I said, okay, I'm going to be an investor in tech for operations. And so I made 400 calls of startups working in software for operations. And I discovered quite like three main things. The first thing that I discovered is there are like operation is 25-30% of the world GDP. It's 0.7% of startups. So the first thing that I discovered is that it's a too small world and there are not enough startups working in a space. So that was first. The second thing that I discovered is that very few people having actually scaled the tech company were going into operations. You had a bunch of former manufacturing executives having spotted the pain, but they were not that good at creating a tech company because creating a tech company is a job. Like, then you have to be from there to scale companies. So that was the second realization. The third realization is that usually those companies were very slow in finding product market fit, because it takes like 9 months to go to do your first factory, and then you do the V1 of your product, and it always sucks. And so you have to find iteration 2, 3, and you're 3 years down the line, and you finally found product market fit, but you're exhausted. And so I found the three things, and I said, okay, I'm going to lose my money. Just stop, because there's not enough startups, they are not made by tech people, and they are slow. Okay,
yeah,
I'm going to lose my money. So I started reading a bunch and I said, okay, I'm going to create a startup studio, but I'm going to solve for those three things. So not enough startups, I'm going to create them. The people are not from tech, I'm going to recruit people from tech, usually second tech founders, and tell them, come on, and let's work on the 25% of the economy that matters. And so that was second. And the third one is we created a network of factories and factory executive and those kind of people. And we said to them, look, we are going to go to your factories. We are going to scan for pain points and things we can do with technology. And if we find something that is repeatable, we are going to build and to solve the thing. And it's going to be free until it works.
Yeah.
And that was made to accelerate the product market fit finding. And so when I go and see founders, tech founders, I said to them, okay, very simple. You have 25% of the world economy just there waiting for digitization. And I have that secret network of factories, and I already know that this and this and this and this are pain points, and you can solve for that and create a big company. And your choice is very clear. Either you go and raise some funds and try to do it all by yourself, or you go to SS Venture and you use the infrastructure that we created to do in less than 1 year what would take you 3 years and more dilution. And so that's literally what we do. And so, yes, it's different, but it's literally just solving for the issues that we see with the space, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I guess there's a few things there. So I guess, you know, that differentiator that I was talking about is probably that most venture studios look across a broad range of different verticals, whereas you've very much, you know, stuck to your knitting, focus on operations. I think your point around, you know, operations being 25% of GDP, you and I have talked, you know, I have a very strong background in manufacturing operations in Africa and elsewhere. But it's not just 25% of GDP, it's also 50% of workers, 60% of emissions, right? 90% of the economy is hardware, but as you say, only, you know, 0.7% of VC funding goes to these startups, or, you know, there are very few startups in that space. Although I think that's changing, because interestingly, I had you know, a recent conversation with Francesco Perticarari on the podcast. He's you know, the managing partner of Siddiq and Roundabout Ventures here in the UK, investing in deep tech and hard tech, that shift, I think we're seeing, and we're going to talk about this in a second, in terms of atoms over bits, is very much happening. We're seeing it across, you know, the US and the UK and Europe. But I also wanted to ask you, you know, and I think we may have talked about this in the past, was there a moment where you kind of realized that, you know, there was just this massive change to be had in the sort of manufacturing space? Was there sort of, was there any kind of, I don't know, anything that you would point to that was like, actually, you know, this is the thing that just got me focused on that?
For sure. And to me, it was visiting Tesla Fremont.
Right.
So it's a plant in California, the first plant of Tesla. And in 10 years of operations, I've been to, I think, hundreds of factories. And I thought I had seen a lot of what had to be seen. And I went to Tesla and everything was so fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. To put it bluntly, if you buy $100 worth of Tesla car, there are $15 of software.
Wow.
Half in the car and half in the factory.
Yeah.
If you do the same with a Ford, it's $4. And so everything is defined by software.
Yeah.
The architecture of the car is software-defined vehicle. The architecture of the factory is modeled on a CPU. Mm-hmm. And so the principles used to create the factory is the same principle in CPU to compress time and space and maximize throughput. And literally, when I made that visit, I thought to myself, okay, in the next 20 years, every single physical company is going to be more like Tesla.
Yeah.
It's as if I had been a visitor in the first factory at Toyota 30 years ago when they invented Lean.
Mm-hmm.
And in 30 years ago, you go to Toyota and they were doing things so different. Like there were less machines, there was incredible variety, people were creating standards and those weird rituals all over the plant, everything. And I thought to myself, okay, in the next 10 to 30 years, every single physical operational company is going to be more like Tesla and less than Ford, like Ford. And so I thought to myself, okay, I have to be in that space. And literally, it was half rational and half totally irrational. It was, I have to be in that space.
Hey guys, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to introduce you to our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Emerge One. Emerge One CFOs partner with VC-backed founders from seed to series B to manage and raise capital and plan how it should be deployed, controlling cash so that they can do what they do best to scale strategically. You can find them at emergeone.co.uk. That's emergeone.co.uk. Okay, let's get back to the episode. Yeah. The interesting thing from my perspective, again, you know, having seen lots of factories, is that the idea of manufacturing is still in the 1900s, right? Yes,
yeah.
There's been automation. Yes, there's been improvements, etc. But fundamentally, especially when you go to more developing economies, you know, I mean, I remember I was out in Papua New Guinea, the plant that we were running to produce our foam was the same plant that we had acquired in 1975 from the previous, you know, from the, or 70, whenever it was, from the previous guys who were out there who had run that plant for 20 years prior to that, right? Like, I mean, that equipment hasn't changed, the process hasn't changed. And then, of course, you know, and then I went to Australia to one of our factories where we had the highest tech of equipment. Now, yes, it was more technologically advanced, but it was the same process, right? And the same thinking around how that process should run. And I guess what you're saying is it isn't just the hardware that needs to change. It isn't just the software that needs to change. It is actually the thinking and design of these plants, of these manufacturing operations, that needs to be brought into the 21st century. I don't even know which century we're in, but certainly into 2024, because otherwise you don't have an edge. And, you know, to your point, you know, the way everyone talks about a Tesla, it's a computer with a car body around it, right? It isn't a car. It is a piece of software, which I learned, by the way, very sadly, a couple of weeks before Christmas, and we were about to drive down to Italy, and the brakes failed. Now, this wasn't a software issue, but it's all interlinked, right? And there was no way that we could solve that problem. It had to go back to Tesla, and they had to resolve it, which they did. But even actually, the service experience was fully online, right? Like, yeah. You know, we were getting texts from the service engineer saying, okay, we've identified the problem. This is what needs to happen. Do you approve this? Everything done, like, absolutely, you know, via the app, which A, was great because it kept me in the loop, and B, it was just frictionless, right? And I guess what we hope we will be heading towards in terms of manufacturing is that frictionless experience on the factory floor as well, right?
That's for sure. And to your point, for example, the braking function in a Tesla is mostly software.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing in the US where the newspaper said, yeah, Tesla is doing a recall because they are changing their braking system. It was a software update.
Yeah.
It was a software update because they changed the way you brake by using software remote update. And one thing also that I think has been totally overlooked is that the engineers at Tesla, at SpaceX, and other companies, they come from Apple.
Right.
And Apple thinking is hardware is the platform for software.
Yeah.
And so what happens if you think a car with, as a fundamental principle, hardware is a platform for software. Mm. Another example is, of course, SpaceX. SpaceX is a platform. The hardware of SpaceX is a platform for software to foster re-entry and everything. And maybe another example that I love is Coty. So Coty, they are doing perfumes. It's a L'Oreal competitor. And Coty, the guy told me that now he could do perfumes with a batch size of one.
Really?
Why? Because software codes for the machines, computer vision, optimize all the process, and so you can do batch size of one for perfumes.
And for context, right, because I think people will be like, okay, what does that mean? Well, if you're ordering from factories, your batch size is typically, you know, your minimum order quantities are typically running into certainly the hundreds, if not the thousands. To be able to produce a batch size of one efficiently, and that's the point, efficiently, is incredible, because it means you can essentially personalize or tailor make any product to customer specifications. I mean, that's incredible.
And this has huge indication. Let's take an example that I love, which is drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for medicine today, around, let's say, 10 to 15% of all long-term diseases are diseases where the batch size of all the people in the world having the same illness is so low that doing one medicine is like $1 million.
Yeah.
And so if you reduce the batch size and you are able to do mass personification by leveraging software, then you can literally cure those people.
Yeah.
With a good economic equation, because today a lot of people, unfortunately, are dying because we cannot drive the cost of medicine down because of the batch size in the whole world. And so with software, with mass personalization, and with everything like that, we could create so much economic value. And maybe it's one of the next frontiers for really augmenting GDP meaningfully, because we had the digital revolution, we all have iPhones now, and maybe the slowdown in global GDP could be solved with AI and with mass personification of physical goods. And if we do so, there would be a new wave of prosperity for the next 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, we can stop talking about degrowth and like start really tapping into abundance. I think it's absolutely incredible. I mean, one of my clients is not in the hardware space, not in the factory space, but ultimately has built a tool that emulates bacteria interaction with drugs, which allows them to run in silico trials that massively speed up time to drug development, which, you know, then when you take it to the next step, you know, they can then you can then, you know, if you know which drugs work with which human beings, then you can, and if you can get down a line of personalized medicine, then you start, to your point, opening up those opportunities in a massive way. So what are the trends that you're seeing in the space at the moment? Having spent many years in manufacturing myself, I'd imagine that there's not a lot of legacy technologies at play, but equally a large impetus, or not only a large, a lot of legacy technologies at play, but equally a large impetus, especially in the West, to optimize processes and technology that may not have changed much over the last couple of decades. And I guess here we're talking about, you know, onshoring, reshoring, and these sort of issues, which, you know, again, as I was talking to Francesco last week, you know, we talked about it in the context of essentially security, right? But not security necessarily from a defense perspective, but food security, making sure that you have control over your systems, your logistics, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, hang on. So what are you seeing as trends?
So the first trend, and it's extremely clear, is resilience. And so a lot of CEOs told me that a CEO can only have like two or three main questions in her head at all time. And the main question switched from what can be my profit in the next 2 years to how can I secure the fact that I'm still in business in 5 years? Mm-hmm. Which is a fundamentally different question to ask. And during COVID, with the supply chain crisis, everyone knows how fragile the world system is, and everyone is working on resilience. So you cannot create everything, you cannot supply everything. You have to be part of an ecosystem, but what is that ecosystem? Where is it located? How resilient it is? Can it absorb shock, and so on. It's the top CEO priority almost everywhere in the world. In the US, with the Inflation Reduction Act, there are more factories being built in the last 18 months than in the 6 years prior. And so they really understood that, and they are pushing hard. In Europe, it's coming, let's put it like that. And the biggest shift is actually that most factories are at least not out of China, but they are in China, but hedging their bets and putting a lot of manufacturing in India. Mm-hmm. India is becoming fast the new hub of the manufacturing and operational world. So that would be the main trend. And it is very clear that it's the main trend. I would say that the second trend is that there are a lot of verticals being totally disrupted by software. Mm-hmm. And some verticals are saying, okay, will we get disrupted by software? So the two absolutely clear verticals disrupted by software are automotive and space. Like, there are more launch made by SpaceX than by the entire EU ecosystem and China combined this year. And it's thanks to software. So those verticals are clearly being disrupted. And some verticals, it's still unclear. For example, in textile, Shein, which is a textile giant startup, they went to 9 billion sales in 6 years. And they and their entire supply chain is run by 15 people, and they're all data scientists.
Sorry, their entire supply chain for Shein, which is,
yes.
I mean, if I were to take my daughter as a subset of the user group that uses Shein, I mean, how can 15 data scientists run the logistics? That is absolutely mind-blowing.
It's actually a very interesting case study. They created an ERP, which is the big system to manage supply chain, everything. And they give the ERP for free to their suppliers.
Yeah.
And when they have new batch order to be made, they propose it to all the suppliers that are partners. And the supplier can say, okay, I will produce it at this price. And then the supply chain is automatically managed this way. And so basically, they are not collaborating with the suppliers. They are the ERP of the suppliers.
Yeah. So they've embedded themselves into the suppliers' manufacturing process or processes. Yeah.
And so this software distribution function is so massive that the difference between Shein and Zara is greater than the difference between Zara and traditional retailers. And Zara was already a business school case study in how to go fast from prototyping to blah, 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 blah. At Shein, it's like several days, some weeks at max. And so this kind of disruption is purely software disruption. Yeah. So basically, at Shein, your daughter orders and creates a batch size in the ERP of some Bangladeshi or Chinese guy, and they produce a thing.
And ship it.
And the data scientist at Shein is just looking after the fact that it works.
That is mind-blowing. And the incredible thing there is, of course, Shein, it's a bit like Amazon from that perspective, right? Like, so, you know, if you think about Amazon, it created AWS as a solution for itself before it started selling it as a third party. Yep. One could imagine that Shein, having created this logistics infrastructure or software, essentially, could spin it out as a standalone product, which they could sell to others. Now, obviously, they might not do that because that is partly their competitive advantage, right? But, you know, you can imagine that being as big as just the retail side of them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting is that the product manager who did this is a former Tencent product manager. Mm. And so those are people from the software world.
Yeah.
And they are disrupting a heavily clinical part of the world. So that would be the second big trend. And the third trend is obviously AI. Mm-hmm. What's very interesting is that AI is coming at scale, but not where we thought it would come, if it makes sense. So, for example, everyone was talking about self-driving and everything. It is becoming a reality at a very slow pace compared to what was promised. But what is already live in your BYD, Build Your Dream, which is a Chinese car company, is that most of the functions are embedded with AI. Fuel consumption is aided by AI. Your car basically drives like your car because they are optimizing for you using AI. And so your car physically reacts differently to your driving because of some AI embedded in your car. And that is live. And so basically in all products and in all processes, it's coming live. Another example from BYD is what is called the giga casting process. Mm-hmm. So giga casting process is creating the hull of a car in one go. So you have a giga casting, it creates the hull just by casting in one go.
So you're no longer having to weld and assemble and,
Exactly. Only two companies in the world are doing that, BYD and Tesla. And it's 40% software, meaning that the casting process is actually not the same based on the sensors that you have. And they are looking at how the matter is reacting while you are doing the casting. And so at the end, you have the same hull. And it makes it so that you can create the hull in one go. And if you do that, times the number of processes that are in your plants, you end up with a cost advantage, which is that, just to give you a hint, the Seagull, which is the new BYD, it's priced at $12,000. And it's better than the Peugeot alternative, which is $26,000.
Wow. Well, I mean, bring it on. I mean, you know, more competition, lower prices.
Exactly.
I mean, happy days, right?
Exactly.
Just before we kind of end up, from your perspective, what are the significant differences between building in the pure software space versus building in the physical space? And what advice would you give to founders that are looking to launch something in that sort of a vertical today?
Yep.
So I guess built environment versus software.
Yes. We only invest in software, but I am an investor in several hardware and hard tech startups. I would say that one counterintuitive truth about hardware is that it's easier to sell physical stuff
Yes.
But it's way harder to do a gigantic company. But if you do a gigantic company in the hardware space, then you're in the top 10. It can be massive. Yeah. So, and there is a good reason for that, which is that selling physical stuff, it sells. But to have an actual 10x better product in the physical world is very, very hard. Mm. But when you do, it's a massive opportunity. And so the one advice that I would give, if I may, to hardware founders and people building actual stuff is to say, don't chase the 20% better. Don't chase that because it's harder to build in the physical world. It's longer. There is more capital needed. So the opportunity and the gap in performance that you propose must be massive.
Yeah.
It mustn't be okay. It must be massive. And for example, we were talking about the humanoid robot. We can speak about other hardware, but the humanoid robot, I think the guy said it's probably a 200 and something million dollar investment before being live.
Wow.
Sam Altman is looking to raise
a trillion.
7,000 billion to do the new generation of chips to advance AI, which is interesting. Sam Altman at the end of the day says software is cool and AI is cool and it's going to change the world.
But
and bottleneck is hardware.
Yeah.
And so give me 7 trillion. I don't know if he'll succeed, but at the end of the day, he goes for the massive hardware opportunity because he's a kick-ass founder.
Yeah, I mean, 7 trillion, you know, he's thrown out that number. And of course, a lot of people have sort of sat there and gone, no way, Sam, like, what are you talking about? You're smoking crack. But the reality is, one would imagine that he will raise a large portion of that. He may not hit the 7 trillion, but he may well raise, you know, a significant enough seed, you know, fund, call it seed. I mean, like, you know, it would surpass any seed funding ever raised. But you know, if anyone's going to do it, he's going to be the guy. And Renan, you know, just before we wrap up, you've had your first exit from the portfolio. So talk us through that.
Yes, 2 weeks ago. So Niagara is a company that produces an ETL, extract transform load. So you can basically extract all informations from machines and put them in the right place with the right data structure. And so you can use it to look for performance gaps, analysis, and everything. So they were live since like a little more than 2 years and having good traction. And they sold themselves to a US-based company based in San Francisco, doing software automation. And we are very glad because it's our first exit. And we've been live for 4 years. So having your first exit at year four is amazing. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, look, congratulations to both you and them. I think that's a really, really incredible result. And obviously shows that hopefully the model is working and will continue to work. For our audience, Renan, where is the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where can they find you on the internet?
Sure. So on LinkedIn at Renan de Villiers and on the web at oss.ventures. We are always looking for talented founders. We are always looking for visionaries, COOs and factory directors saying, I want in, I want to put some software in my factory, I want to change the game. We are very lucky to have an ecosystem of incredible people all trying to do the same thing, which is put software in operations.
Amazing. Renan, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. It's been wonderful having you here.
Thank you so much. It was fun talking to you.
Amazing.